white men who wear Nike Tech. Mm. Yeah.
Boy Genius.
That's all I had, so you have to keep going.
I have Boy Genius. Mm-hmm. I have 3D printed D&D figurines.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Queen St. Patrick's Day.
Mm.
And the foster care system.
Oh, I feel like that one would, they would be like, I get it.
You're actually right.
Yeah.
Redacted. Well, I'm glad you had a fun little time with us.
Yeah.
Sorry to all the Victorian children listening.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I'm not really that sorry. They can't even hear this anyway. They're going to be dead by now. But it's fine. It's whatever.
They're probably listening to this in their their Spotify playlist.
Yeah. The Victorian children.
Yeah.
Why are we so in sync today? Like that band.
Mm. Yeah. In sync. Well, love you, baby girls. We'll see you next week. And
I hope you enjoyed this episode of
Be Banter. The only show.
Be Banter.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
On CFRC 101.9 FM, every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m., you'll hear Finding a Voice. My name is Bruce, host of that poetry-focused spoken word program. On it, you'll hear local readings and events, occasionally telephone interviews across Canada, and always a touch of music. Again, Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
Hello, and welcome to the Kingston Curator here on 101.9 FM CFRC. CFRC Arts Coordinator Lauren Tucker here, and I'm very happy to be your host, bringing you arts headlines, interviews, and our live music calendar all throughout the summer. Today's episode marks our Season 3 finale, as we've reached the end of another summer. This week, we're continuing our season wind down with a special featuring some of the best of our 2024 interviews. We've been privileged to have a variety of wonderful and insightful local and visiting artists to Kingston stop by on the show, and we want to feature just some of the highlights to thank them for their time and encourage you to go back and listen to their full interviews if something catches your ear. We'll have all that plus your live music calendar coming your way this hour on The Curator, but for now, here are your arts headlines for the week. Beginning September 3rd and running until the 14th at the Union Gallery is Home Again, Queen's Fine Art Alumni Exhibit. Marking 55 years of fine art education at Queen's, this exhibition of visual artwork from fine arts and arts education alumni will be a showcase, celebration, and expression of the hopes for the future of the program. This exhibition includes work from over 70 alumni and is free for the public to peruse during open hours in the main space. Exhibition hours may vary, and you can learn more at uniongallery.queensu.ca. Continuing this month at the TED until August 31st, we'll be Contemplating Glaciers, A Dialogue, a solo exhibition from artist Jan Kabatov, curated by Jessica Turner, and this exhibition will include photography, sculpture, paintings, video, audio, and even a virtual reality element using the Oculus headset and footage from a documentary on the melting of the Athabasca Glacier, currently in production from this creative team. All ages are welcome to peruse this exhibition in the TED Center Gallery, and it is free to do so, though exhibition hours may vary. There's also upcoming workshops on topics like Indian folk art, scrapbooking, monoprinting, and watercolor in September, as well as new events and exhibitions at the TED all the time. To learn more, you can visit tedcenter.org. Registration for fall term programming at the Kingston School of Art is now open, including programs for youth and adults, as well as workshops and summer camps. This includes adult classes in drawing, fiber and textile arts, mixed media, painting, printmaking, and sculpture, and youth programs for kids ages 6 to 16 and families. There are also a variety of 1 and 2 day workshops available for registration. For more information and to register, visit ksoa.info. At Modern Fuel Art Gallery, in partnership with the Union Gallery, is the Twofold Artist-in-Residence program, led by co-directors Jill Glatt and Berlin Reed. This program provides an opportunity for local BIPOC artists to dive into their practices, collaborations, and discussions while having access to designated workspaces, professional development and mentorship, communal events, and a studio visit platform. This year's Artists-in-Residence are Shanique Pert, Alicia Udvari, Shamara Pert, and Samira Khan, who worked at the Union Gallery in July and Modern Fuel Art Gallery in August. Also coming up at Modern Fuel are three new exhibitions beginning September 14th and running until November 9th. In the main gallery is In the Shadow of the Sun by regional artist Alyssa Scott. In the State of Flux Gallery is A Common Babble by extra-regional artist Nikita FK. And in the Window Gallery is Artwork, Care Work, Portraits of Artists / Mothers by extra-regional artist Claire Drummond. For more, visit modernfuel.org. Every Monday at Daft Brewing, Bon Evans hosts Music Trivia Mondays at 7 p.m. Put your music knowledge to the test in four more rounds of trivia, whether you're going it solo or in a team, with clips, questions, and more. The winning team walks away at the end of the night with a $50 gift card and bragging rights, so be sure to check it out for a Monday night of music and fun. This is also your last week to catch movies in the square in Springer Market Square. Lilo and Stitch starts at dusk on Thursday, August 29th. Be sure to mark your calendars now and bring your blankets, chairs, and bug spray to experience your favorite films for free this summer under the stars. Coming up at Kingston's Independent Cinema, The Screening Room, you can catch special screenings of 1963's The Birds on August 29th as part of the Summer Alfred Hitchcock Presents series. As well, a 40th anniversary screening of Purple Rain will also be playing on August 29th. Coraline returns for 15th anniversary screenings on August 30th, 31st, and September 1st through 5th. 2006's Little Miss Sunshine will be showing August 31st and September 1st to 4th, and Ghostbusters will be showing on August 31st and September 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th. There are also new arrivals and special screenings all the time, so be sure to check back at screeningroomkingston.com for all of your cinema adventures. First on our season highlights for this season finale is part of our interview with the National Youth Orchestra of Canada's CEO, Christy Gray, and violinist, Jonathan Mailman. This took place during their concert series at the Isabel back in June, and we have more on classical music and opportunities for local and Canadian youth from our June 28th episode.
Folks to feel like classical music is for them, regardless of their training or background, whether they've been listening to or playing classical music for years, or if they're brand new. We want folks to feel like they can come to the concerts and enjoy. We are really hoping to see a wide range of community members at the concerts, which is why they're free admission. For many of the concerts on our tour as well, we do pay what you can ticketing in order to make things as accessible as possible to as many audience members as possible. Classical music has sort of had a history of being for perhaps the elite audience, and we really want to break down some of those barriers, that this is something that everyone can enjoy. It can be a time to unplug, to relax, to learn something new, to expand your imagination, and hear music that maybe you aren't used to. So definitely we hope to see a lot of community members out to the concerts and really enjoying these fantastic young musicians and all they're going to bring to the stage. One of the things that we're really looking to do more and more as we head into the future is think about who is being represented as composers in our selections. So typically we're looking at dead white guys, and we really want to think about how we can break free of some of that and look at some of the less represented composers. So women and people of color. For instance, we're playing an amazing string quartet by Tanya Tagak, who is an Inuit composer, later on in Chamberfest, as one example. And, you know, really thinking about who is included in the composers we're performing, as well as who's included in the audience.
So, Jonathan, as a youth performer yourself, I was wondering how you might describe to your peers what you enjoy and how they could maybe start enjoying this type of music.
Yeah, so I would definitely say I enjoy a lot of, like, if we're talking about like modern programming and stuff like that, I really like music that incorporates musical influences from different genres as well. Besides classical music, you know, I do like Celtic and jazz, and I enjoy some vintage rock music as well. So, you know, it's once you start incorporating all these different genres, it definitely makes it a lot more accessible to younger audiences who generally would listen to something else. But, you know, like, if it catches their ear once, like, then, like, they could be hooked for life, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's just great to see, you know, and NYU doing such a diverse programming as well. It's really nice to see that we're incorporating all these different genres and influences as well, so.
Awesome. And so what I'm understanding, what I'm kind of hearing from you is that within this classical program, you kind of see a variety of kind of something for everybody, would you say?
Yeah, I would say that. And, you know, it's also important to showcase, like, the like hundreds and hundreds of years, the legacy of classical music as well. So like once you bring all of that together, it's just perfect. You know, like we have stuff for the younger audiences, we have stuff for the returning concert goers. It's just great that, you know, NYU has such a diverse programming, and it's just great in that way.
We definitely do look at the career, the role that the organization has in the career trajectory of young musicians, how we're supporting them in sort of launching their careers, things like audition preparation, making sure that they're learning the skills and techniques that they need to go on into a professional environment. And, you know, I think we're also creating a community. So regardless of whether they go on to a professional career in music, this is something they have to fall back on, the training, the professionalism that they learn through NYO Canada is applicable in so many different career paths. So whether they go into music or whether they go on to some other career, they'll have those skills for life. And especially now, post-COVID, we're also really looking at creating opportunity and space for young people in a time that's been very challenging for young people, looking forward to their futures, to create a community of support and encouragement that they can feel like they're part of something larger than themselves, which is something we find is very important, especially these days.
Up next are dancers Chanel Williams and Shanique Pert, who joined us on our July 4th episode to chat about their local artist residency at the Kingston Grand, as well as the process of creating a dance and a bit more about the Ground Up Dance Festival they were both a part of.
And you talked a little bit about having the idea to create this piece for some time now. What would you say is the driving idea or ideas behind this piece in particular?
Yeah, I'll let Chanel take this one, actually.
It's actually a funny story because it originally started as a concept for my third year piece. So I brought along Shanique and another individual by the name of Petra. And we kind of explored my time at York University. It was a time where I was going through many phases as a BIPOC artist. I felt so many different emotions and I did not know how to express it at the time. And kind of like what Shanique was saying, there was a lot of parameters, not only because of the pandemic, but there was a lot of parameters being in a program that was predominantly white and not like accommodating to Black folk and their ways of and modes of expression. So this piece really was a mode of resistance in kind of exploring the different stages, and not just for myself, like bringing along Shanique and Petra, it evolved into something that was extremely collaborative, from music to costuming to movement to everything in between. We were allowed to really express ourselves in a way that we're not really allowed to express ourselves in certain spaces. So the piece really started as just a safe space beyond just movement and creation. It was a space for three individuals to come together and really just have fun and express all the emotions that they were feeling at the moment. And this is exactly what this piece is going to seek to do now, because we're at a totally different spot in our life as BIPOC artists navigating the scene. We're in between projects, we're doing everything under the sun, but we're also in a space where we're like, we haven't created together in years and without parameters and restrictions. So we are just trying to find the flow and really just be who we are in this space, like unapologetically.
Could you describe a little bit what your creative process, your headspace is like to actually like create, choreograph, and present a piece like this?
Oh, that's a great question. I've been in a lot of spaces as of lately, and I just came off training like super intense with a crew here in Toronto. And I've had to really step away from the process that I was in 2020, for example, where it was very much you go with the flow, you use prompts, you use ways to kind of enter your work and be like authentic. And I've been in a space lately where I've forced myself to create things that are not necessarily like good for me or feel good in my body, but I'm necessarily presenting to just hold a certain standard. So I think this creative process in general is going to be a point where I can return to just movement that feels good and that authenticity that I thrive to always have in my work. I know Shanique has different processes and I have different processes as well, but I think the thing that I'm most excited about is being able to just be in the same space together and bounce off one another's ideas, because we flow very well together and like we're actually really, really good friends outside of like creation. So I know it's going to be a blast to just not think and just do. I think that's what I'm looking forward to the most in creation, is not having to think, is just be with a person that you really, really care about and enjoy being around and allow the movement to speak for itself.
Yeah, and I'm on the other end of that where the pandemic, family life things, it actually deterred me from the art scene for a bit. And so I have been in a lot of different spaces outside of the arts community, outside of the dance community. And so I'm really excited for this residency because I feel like not only do I get to create with like one of my best friends in the whole world, and probably one of the most talented people I know, but I also am like given this opportunity to come back to myself and my movement and throw all the like anxiety and the extra thoughts, just throw it out the door, leave it at the door and just move and create. And I have not had the opportunity to just do that for a while. So I think whatever happens and whatever comes out of this week is going to be so beautiful. Because there's authenticity and real life behind the piece, you know? And I think it's really cool because we're not just representing, you know, a group of people, but we're representing ourselves, not only in this moment and who we are, but who we're becoming and the little Shanique and Chanel that brought us here as well. And it's really cool to just kind of honor that part of our journey as well. Technique is beautiful and like emotion is beautiful, but I feel like because we both kind of have those pockets in different areas, like when they come together, the technique and the emotion and like authenticity of the piece will like come together. And that is also, I feel like, really hard to come by these days. I think people are creating from like a commercial space and like a let's put out content kind of space and like, how can we fit this for social media and not really for like bodies of work anymore. So I feel like I'm grateful and lucky because I am going to be able to do that with Chanel, and I'm seeing more of that in Kingston, and it's like exciting to see. And that's also one of the reasons why I was like, yeah, this is the perfect place, but this is also like the right time to do it.
Yeah, and actually we hear that from folks a lot, you know, that there's something to be said for the easy access of social media, but the kind of focus on like contentification or content of the arts, as opposed to allowing folks the kind of breathing room to really work on something that is maybe a little bit different. Do you find that exciting to know that you then have that time and space without the pressure of being able to boil it down to kind of a 30-second what have you?
Absolutely. Like Chanel and I just have so many late night conversations about things like this because, yeah, like let's get real again, you know, let's unfiltered, let's let it all out, whether it's good or not, or digestible or not, or like pleasing to people or not. Like, let's just kind of, I hate to be cheesy, but like, let's just tell our truths, you know, and leave it on the floor. And whoever is meant to receive that and is supposed to receive that will receive that. And whoever is not, it's not for you, you know? It's not.
I think we talk about art and its subjectivity all the time, but then when it's time to have those conversations about digestibility and if it's actually a thing that people can like obtain and see as real, we kind of shy away from it, and then we still want to filter ourselves. And just being unapologetically us, especially as Black women on the scene, in the scene, around the scene, it is very important for us to just be 100% us without filter.
And honestly, too, like, you never know who's watching. Not necessarily, like, oh, there might be a producer in the audience and they want to, like, sign me. Like, no, like, I wish I saw more pieces like this as a kid. You know, I wish I saw more pieces like this growing up. I wish I saw more pieces like this when we couldn't afford dance classes, you know? Because yeah. There is for you in every space. You just need to find it. And honestly, it shouldn't be so hard to look. It really shouldn't. And so... a big thing I like to talk about is like being put on this earth to create, but being put on this earth to inspire as well. And I have such a heart for that, and I have such a heart for like mentoring. And even if one person like sees this piece and is moved, like I think that is one of the most beautiful things about art and creation and dance for me. I'm like, you can be in a room with 1,000 people and put your art out there and present your art, and it can be interpreted in 1,000 different ways, and yet it's still the interpretation of your art, and that is the goal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Next up is a highlight from our July 11th episode featuring local singer-songwriter Anthea Fever, who stopped by to give us a look at the process of creating their new single, Bedtime Story, and upcoming album. Here's a clip with more about accessibility and networking in the music industry, as well as the new music to come.
I'm feeling like, at least when I was at this conference, the Folk Music Ontario conference, it felt like very thriving and very much like people were wanting to reconnect. A lot of musicians seem to have worked on a lot of things during COVID. You know, a lot of them wrote albums and recorded them. So yeah, like there's, I think, a great desire and wish to be networking and together in community, because that's what music is all about. But I do also feel like, yeah, there's a struggle right now with just the music and performance industry and how sustainable it is coming out of COVID, when, yeah, a lot of artists are maybe not getting, like, it's more difficult to tour, it's more difficult to travel, it has been for a while. There's different sides of it. I would say for me personally, it's always a bit of a challenge to network, being very shy.
Yeah.
It is challenging to be a neurodivergent person in the music industry. I mean, in any industry, but especially the music industry is very intense. It's very demanding, and it's very, like, you need to be on all the time. Loud noises, bright lights, crowded spaces. And I was actually quite lucky at the Folk Music Ontario conference because they had for the first time, a designated peer workshop where it's a workshop space where it's run by an artist, a musician, and everyone's invited to be there who wants to. And it was a peer workshop on being neurodivergent in the music industry. And it was just getting together and chatting about that and what can we do about that. So there's positive movement in acknowledging that it's a struggle. The other thing that came up during that peer workshop was that it's not just a struggle for neurodivergent people. It's the music industry is a struggle for any person because it's a lot for anyone to be doing all that all the time and to be shouldering all the responsibilities, you know, of being your own artist and being a manager and doing all your promo and all your social media and all the logistics. Like, that's just a lot for humans. And I also always hope that something is maybe learned or taken away, because some of the music that I play feels niche to some audiences in that, like, I pull a lot of songs from the 19th century, the early 20th century, and, like, the beginning of the recorded music industry, and I like to share a lot of sort of knowledge about the music that I'm playing, and so it's always great for me when, like, the audience might interrupt me to ask questions or something, and, like, that feels really good, which I guess comes to, like, the ultimate thing that I want out of performance, which is just connection, and it also maybe goes back a bit to that, like, being neurodivergent and connection with other people can be a difficult thing sometimes. And to me, music is the thing that's easy. Like, that is an easy way to connect with people. And it's a really meaningful way to connect with people. And so, yeah, a good performance like that I feel like is good for me and for the audience is one where I feel like we're making a connection together through the music. but I can I can tell the fine folks here at CFRC that my album Summer's Morning is coming out on September 20th. And so Bedtime Story is the first single I'm releasing, and it is coming out on August 1st. Like you said, it's the first song on the album, so it's the very first track, and it's also the oldest track. I wrote the lyrics to that song when I was 15, 16. I was still in high school. It's the earliest song that I've written that I still perform or have anything to do with. But yeah, I wrote the lyrics, and then they were shoved away in an angsty notebook somewhere, and then I rediscovered them in my like early 20s, and I thought, hey, this is not bad. This is some pretty decent writing. I don't remember what tune I was playing to this, so I wrote the music to it. It was like 5 or 6 years after it was written, maybe even more. I don't remember now. But I play the song a lot live. I kind of like to end with it because it's a very sweet sort of like love song. It's like a fairy tale love song. And I've always gotten a really positive response from it and just hadn't gotten around to recording it. And so when I was conceptualizing this album, I was like, well, Bedtime Story has to be on it. I mean, my mom would be really sad if it wasn't. So it has to be. And then I decided to put it as the first track so that people could have a nice, happy introduction. And then, spoiler alert, the second track is really devastating. So, you know, you come in high and you're like, life is great. And then, well, you'll just have to wait till the album comes out to see what's going to happen next.
For today's live music lineup, I'll be featuring shows from fantastic local and visiting acts fast approaching to Kingston. Keep it locked because you won't want to miss these details. This Thursday, August 29th, it is the last Thursday of the month tradition at the club at RCHA as they host Beats Workin'. The show plays from 7 to 10 p.m. and it is just $5 to attend. Also this evening, head down to Hotel Wolf Island for alt country band Cody Allen James and Good Company as they play a show from 7 to 10 p.m. Admission is free. Also this Friday, enjoy a happy hour TGIF with Dan Charbonneau at the club at RCHA. Enjoy tunes and a good time from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. and admission is free. But you can stay and grab a drink for the Calorie Night Band from 8 to 11 p.m., for which tickets are just $5. Also on Friday, Birds of a Feather with Kelly Latimer and John Wilberforce are giving you a smooth delivery and lots of harmony at the Cove Inn. The show is 5 to 8 p.m. and admission is by donation. Also on Friday, Hotel Wolf Island hosts a rare North American performance from Dutch singer-songwriter BJ Bartmans. The show is from 6 to 8 p.m. and admission is by donation. Also on Friday, head over to the Mansion for a triple header from North by North, The Backsteps, and Monarch. Rock out, grab a drink, and enjoy the show for $15. Doors are at 7 p.m. Also on Friday, The Merchant hosts local rock band Luscious with special guest Piner. The show runs from 10:30 p.m. to 1 a.m. The show is $12 to attend, and you can hang out and have a good time. Also on Friday, rock out with father-daughter band Sweet Leaf at the Royal Tavern 2.0 this Friday. The show is from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. and is free to attend. You can also swing by Springer Market Square on Friday evening for Kickin' It Country with local country musician Scott Owen. The tunes are from 7 to 8 p.m. and the show is free to attend. On Saturday, August 31st, enjoy the brassy sound of Big Fat Horn Band with special guest vocalist Jasmine Woodbogish. The show runs from 8 to 11 p.m. at the club at the RCHA, and tickets are $30. Also on Saturday, head down to Confederation Park for free live music. Enjoy the music from Sarah Zanibi, Who's Here, and Nice On. The tunes play from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. and the show is for all ages. Also on Saturday, the Cove Inn hosts soulful indie rock group The Amanda Keeley Quartet. The show is from 5 to 8 p.m. and admission is by donation. Also on Saturday, Drill Hall at Base 31 hosts Canadian rock legends Trooper and Honeymoon Suite. The show is bound to have you singing and dancing all night long. Doors are at 7 p.m. and tickets range from $79 to $169. Also on Saturday, enjoy the beautiful view at the Juniper Cafe with the soulful musical stylings of Frank Ryan. Grab a coffee and relax with the tunes from 4 to 6 p.m. This show is free to attend. Also on Saturday, put on your best leather and bang your head at the Mansion. Hard rock groups Sons of Static, No Small Affair, and Stun Seed are giving you all that rock energy, and doors are at 9:30 p.m. Tickets are just $20 at the door. Also on Saturday, head over to the Spearhead Brewery for local artist Tom Savage. The afternoon show is from 2 to 5 p.m. and admission is free. Kingston-based rock duo Roderick and Bairstow are playing rock, country, and folk at the Spearhead Brewery on Saturday. Grab a drink and watch the show from 7 to 10 p.m. Admission is free. Also on Saturday, head down to the Toucan for rock band Sweet Pete and the Heat. The late night set goes from 10:30 p.m. to 2 a.m. and admission is free. On Sunday, September 1st, the patio at the Cove Inn presents live jazz and contemporary with Head Over Heels. The show is from 5 to 8 p.m. and admission is by donation. For more on these awesome local shows, you can visit kingstonlive.ca. Up next on our highlights of 2024 is a clip from our July 18th episode of The Curator, featuring artist Kelby James, whose exhibition The Garden of Forbidden Fruits and the Laws of Cosmic Consciousness ran in the Union Gallery main space in July. We had a conversation about their process and confronting taboos in art. Take a listen.
The Garden of Forbidden Fruits and the Laws of Cosmic Consciousness comes from the book Nova Express by William Burroughs. Now, it isn't the exact quote. I've actually played with the quote and appropriated it for my own use. I forget how it goes, but I think it's different. The way that I've essentially exchanged the words. And I thought that it really worked for my exhibition because what I'm also talking about is, talking about these elements of control around societal control around what we can and can't experience. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we look at psychedelic substances and, you know, although there's like a lot of progress right now and a lot of hype around and discussion around what these psychedelics can do for us, whether it's, you know, treating anxiety, depression, PTSD, you know, like the list goes on. There still is a lot of stigma and taboo around them and, policing around whether or not we can or can't take these substances. So in some ways, you know, those who, I like to say it like this, is those who experience the forbidden fruits or taste the forbidden fruits are forbidden themselves.
Yes.
So there is sort of like a stigma around, experiencing these really powerful, beautiful substances. And, you know, again, I think that plays into the latter half of the title, the laws of cosmic consciousness in, you know, how can we experience, whether we can experience our consciousness and how far our consciousness can go.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a lot of regulation around these substances. And I wanted to signal that in the title. This isn't just about like, oh yeah, let's trip.
It's deeper
than that. It's talking about, you know, what kind of autonomy we have over our bodies. And the spectrum to which, you know, these psychedelics can operate for us as society, as humans. And, simply the visual aesthetics of these experiences. That's what these prints really represent. And what I was really wanted to generate in a body of work was, the range of emotions that can be felt when you, and feelings that you can feel whilst questing, as I like to say, questing or journeying, tripping. These are all exchangeable words. So it originally started with thinking about, I really wanted to get working with the stone again, the lithography. And that, again, I think working through the process is what brought up these ideas around control and surrender too, because I did have to troubleshoot quite a lot. I worked with three stones at the beginning and two of the three gave me issues. And I had to, again, when you're prepping these stones, there's a lot of work that goes into it. And so I had to really surrender to that experience of putting in like hours and hours and hours for these things not to work out. But I did generate a few solid prints. And then I connected with some other teachers in the art history department, one of which, whose name is Jen Kennedy, who is the undergraduate chair for the art history department. And she and I really connected as well. And I picked their brain a little bit about, you know, what my ideas were. And we had a really great conversation about what I was thinking about. And I was thinking about, you know, the idea of visualizing, psychedelics within the queer body, but also, you know, the interface or the system that becomes activated. As a result of tripping. But also I wanted to be very direct about the psychedelics. So I decided to, you know, reference the molecules, their compounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, what's beautiful about print and print strategies like silkscreen is you can use these methodologies to signal certain ideas through layering. So on the first bottom layer, I have a litho print of a scene that employs photo and drawing into one composition. And so there I'm playing with, you know, the boundary between hallucination and what's real. Mm-hmm. So that's coded onto the base layer.
Yeah.
And then above that, I have the molecule compounds
okay.
that are printed. And they're printed in repetition
mm-hmm.
to signal, you know, that sort of, that feeling of when you're, you know, when you are being, when you're surrendering to the substance, you know, those effects that can happen. I think repetition is definitely one of them that I've experienced at least. And then on top of that, we have the body, and the mm-hmm. body is also in kaleidoscopic colors and is also repeating. And the body is intentionally, androgynous to sort
right.
of signal the queer themes as well that are a big part of what I'm depicting, you know, queer experiences of psychedelics. And so I think that these prints really reflect the idea of the self, the psyche, the substance, and the system or the interface that becomes simulated from taking these psychedelics.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, within and sort of like the queer body as like, you know, the queer psychedelic body as a glitch.
Okay.
Like a glitch to, you know, what were like is the conventional body, you know, the binary body, the normal
yeah.
body. I was really encouraged to use the spaces I felt. And so this felt like I was taking the work into a more personal direction, although I think that the work is speaking to a broader audience in visualizing and bringing discussion towards queer experiences of drugs, of mm-hmm. psychedelics that, you know, I think is still on the fringes of being open to talk about with most folks. You know, I think you can only bring that up to a certain extent
yeah.
with certain people. You know,
yeah.
I had to kind of face a little bit of that myself in the department with some of my colleagues, not many, but mm-hmm. There's a few who are a little bit, you know, tense about that. So I
yeah.
think that it's the work is in this installation is meant to not make people uncomfortable, but make people who might be uncomfortable get comfortable with talking about the possibilities that these substances have.
Yeah.
And, you know, not being stuck on, you know, the adverse stories that we hear of people
yeah.
Having, you know, XYZ bad trip under XYZ substance. 'Cause I think that those sticking on those stories or sticking on that on those conceptions it's not progressive. It's dangerous for those who use them in ways like myself that are, you know, to elevate my mind, broaden my perspective, and be in touch with ultimately Mother Nature. That is sort of at the core of it.
Keeping in our art vein, our August 8th episode featured more from the ongoing exhibition at the Tet, Contemplating Glaciers, A Dialogue with curator Jessica Turner. We chat about the intersections between the past and present when informing artistic themes, and about how art and research can fight back against climate change.
And so leading up to that, it was trying to decide, what am I going to curate? I think every emerging curator and emerging artist are kind of like, where do I want to focus my attention here? Because there's just so many different avenues you can go, especially if you have so many interests. So leading up to that, I started reading more actually about heritage preservation and memory, and thinking, you know, maybe I want to curate an exhibition that could focus on the history of my grandmother's side. She was Russian, and this kind of leads up to how I met Jan. Jan comes from a Dukhobor family, and the Dukhobors were a religious sect, and they were exiled from Russia in the late 19th century. And so they came over to Canada in 1899. And they first were situated in Saskatchewan, and that's actually where my grandmother grew up because she was on a Duke of War farm. And I started reading about Duke of Warism, and I contacted the author of a book that I had read, Our Backs Touched by the Sun, because it's a very moving story, the Duke of Wars in Canada. And I reached out to the author and I said, you know, I think I might want to curate an exhibition on Duke of Wars and their experience in Canada, because it was pretty, there was a lot of tragedy that people don't know that happened with the Duke of Wars in Canada. And it included a residential school system as well in the 1950s in British Columbia. And so I thought that would be a really moving topic. So I contacted the author and I said, you know, is there any artist that you know of that I could curate an exhibition for? And she pointed me to Jan Kabatoff. And I contacted Jan. And she's like, you know, I've created art on the Duke of War experience, but now my focus has been on climate change. So anyway, it made sense because Duke of Wars were very much in tune with nature and with farming, sustainable farming, and foraging and these things. And so I saw Jan's interest in climate change. I understood it as it might be deep within her and her history and her family, you know, of paying attention to nature and how it's responding to us. And she inspired me to continue researching more about, you know, how climate change is being depicted in art and how much work we still have to do as curators and artists to kind of bring the topic to light.
Like, what is the role of curating in academics and researchers, and how is it evolving when it comes to addressing these issues of climate change through art?
That's a really good question, because I think increasingly the field has become more interdisciplinary, and I think there might be a stereotype or an expectation that curators, especially for emerging curators, that they need to have all this knowledge in this particular area. But being interdisciplinary, you can draw on experts and specialists in their field and bring them into the project, and they can inform the project and make it so much better. And the best thing about being in the BFA program at OCAD is that I gained a lot of practical skills in terms of how to execute an exhibition successfully, in terms of placing artworks to have a sort of story, but also the little details of creating a catalog and doing the didactic panels and doing some marketing for it and these sorts of things, hanging and installation. But yeah, I think the curatorial field, if it's especially for independent curators, if it's going to continue to evolve, then curators also need to know that there's so many grants available to help shows actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the Canada Arts Council and Ontario Arts Council, or depending on where you are in Canada, there's different grants depending on the province that you're in. And I think one thing that I wanted the space to be for people was an opportunity to connect with nature, to connect with glaciers, and from that connection, start thinking more about what's happening to the glaciers, how climate change is causing this melting. Because I think it is a little bit of a process. You can tell people to start thinking about climate change, but I think the connection to nature and to Earth needs to be there, or at least it helps being there. So coming out of the exhibition space, I hope people will first start thinking about it, but also hopefully be inspired to see other art exhibitions on the same topic, and maybe look into, you know, the businesses that they're going to, and are they using sustainable products, and, you know, start just being a little bit more aware of the businesses they're going to, but also maybe trying to support more green initiatives, finding out what your government is doing in terms of climate action as well.
Last but certainly not least, we're dipping our toe back into our theater coverage with a highlight of our August 15th episode, featuring the team behind the Kick and Push show, What Brings You In. This multidisciplinary group made for a wonderful interview, and here's just some of the highlights.
So I had started working on this show in 2019, so pre-pandemic. So I was thinking about it as a theatrical sound installation, and I was really in person in venue. And then the pandemic happened, and I got interested in what an online version of the show would feel like, could feel like, without defaulting to a video stream of the thing we were going to do in person, which wasn't fully fleshed out, honestly, in that moment anyway. So what happened was some really foundational development happened while we were also exploring questions around translating live performance and all the feelings and why we go to a live performance and are in a room together, why we like that experience and go for that experience, and how to translate those feelings online. So how do we feel other people experiencing the thing at the same time as you? How do you still feel connection? How do you feel? And then also, I have an interest in creative accessibility, specifically with the blind and low vision community. So also, what if you are a blind person? Then how do all those things translate, and how do we find creative ways to connect us when we're, it's a much different feeling when you are experiencing a show basically at home alone through a screen and headphones. So we looked for a software engineer, and in particular, we wanted someone who was an artist also. So that's how we found and, you know, connected with Ramsey, and maybe I'll let Ramsey. Oh, and then with Matt Rideout. So how did that work? So we were working on translating the sound and music online. So I didn't want to just record it in stereo. I was really interested in translating the acoustics also, and the ideas I had around concept and acoustics and how that would change and translate concepts around experiences I had in therapy and duality and listening and connecting. And so our sound designer, Matt Smith, had experience in ambisonic microphones, which gave us the ability to play with space and direction and being in the middle of the sound, which is different than the being in the audience in the room. But it allowed us just a different way to play with sound. And so we were connected to Matt through the Riser program with Why Not Theater. And then ever since then, I've handcuffed myself to that right out as our podcast and audio engineer, because he has this incredible ability to, you know, what now, like several, 3 years later, it's gone way beyond just demo recording with a small ambisonic microphone into live mixing in the room to 7.1 speakers and online binaurally. So,
do you think there's a particular way that your collaboration as a team, whether that's between the three of you, your broader team, has really kind of evolved or found its stride across your diverse disciplines?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ramsey and Matt might have things to say about this also for sure, but I would say one really interesting challenge has been around vocabulary and language, because there are so many disciplines at play here.
Yeah.
So, you know, now on the team, we have an environmental designer, a sound designer, a broadcast engineer, you know, Ramsey, a software engineer, experience designer, two musicians. So it's really straddled, you know, theater, new music, concert, new media. And so I would say there have been, I wish that we, you know, someone will say a sentence and often I'm like, oh, I have no idea what you're saying, you know, but it's been quite, I really like that. I really like being at the edge of my learning. And so it's been interesting to, you know, meet each other halfway, but maybe Ramsey and Matt have other things to add to that.
Yeah, I feel like it almost mirrors the piece itself, which is sort of sits in this tension between being in person together and being sort of separated but connected by technology. And, you know, when I've done, you know, the ideal way to conceptualize an interactive experience is to be in the space together, and we'll have like a whiteboard or a big pad of paper and markers, and we could like draw and like just even just by reading each other's body languages, like understand what you might mean by the words that you're using. But instead, we're relegated to, you know, WhatsApp and email and Google Docs, and we have to kind of make do with that. And we did, and there was work, and you know, we were able to do that. And I do feel that in a sort of strange way mirrors again the piece itself, where ideally we'd all be in a room together just watching Leslie play, but like that's difficult for a variety of reasons. So we can sort of harness technology to sort of get around that, and it's different, but it's still, you know, beautiful and compelling.
Yeah, I think I think Ramsey and I have kind of the two deepest tech roles, and they're in like kind of different worlds, but we also like literally have to talk to each other, but also our systems have to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And so there's been like, I think Ramsey's been really great to work with, and I think we haven't had a lot of like trouble communicating. It's been pretty smooth, and like we won't have time, and I'm sure your listeners don't care to get into the weeds of this stuff, but there's been a couple moments of problem solving of like problems that we were fighting with for 2-3 years that I'll specifically take my hat off to Ramsey of. The first time I've seen a QR code in a way that didn't make me roll my eyes. that's an inside joke, but solving things about internet delay and servers and stuff and broadcasts going out and things being synced up on the website in ways that just feel smooth and correct for the audience now that are deeply impressive to me and have been a real delight to like see come together and make happen.
It was kind of a slow, I would say, like something that had kind of been missing for me for a while as a more like someone who had been freelancing, working in a more classical, traditional sense. You know, I'd had an orchestral job and I was doing like chamber music and, you know, kind of the usual freelance gigs. And I was missing a connection to the audience that that I wanted more, like I wanted to get my hands in there a bit more, whereas usually like as a classical musician, you're handed music and a schedule and, you know, you here's like, this is what we're doing. We're playing to this movie or we're playing this, you know, show. And I really wanted to get in there and have like more agency around the connection with the audience. And I had done a previous show where I'd gotten a sense that sharing a personal story was really like contextualizing classical music, which has its own life and canon and deep tradition, but contextualizing it in a personal life took the listening in a different direction. And therapy has always been a thing that I've done that for 15 years on and off, and I've always felt that kind of listening has been really intriguing to me. And I mean, contrived, it's you know, an expensive professional stranger but also you know, a skill in listening that I always found so interesting. And the title What Brings You In also comes from getting to ask that question myself when I had this short stint as an optometrist in a past life. And I would start my sessions, my appointments with a patient one-on-one with, so what brings you in? And that's a really common question. A version of that question comes up in therapy when you go for the first time. And for me, it was always a signal of I'm going to do a certain kind of listening right now. And it's a little bit one directional, but it was like a different level of focus and concentration for me. And I think I've been really interested in that from the stage. So the audience performer relationship and that being a kind of odd one directionality, but I'm interested in both the therapist and the audience, but I know I never really get to know either because that's just kind of, that's not how it works, quote unquote. But I so appreciate that kind of listening. Yeah, but I think also like we could all afford to take our listening, even if it is a more back and forth, like mutual conversation, to take our listening to like that deeper level that I think honestly everyone is after. And just from the interviews, I interviewed 50 people on their experiences in therapy, and I think ultimately another level of listening, but also like vulnerability is something that, you know, I wish that I could have more of in life, and then I might not have to go to therapy so much.
And that concludes season 3 of The Kingston Curator here on CFRC 101.9 FM and the end of summer 2024. Thank you so much to each and every one of our interviewees for stopping by to the program, and to you for listening. It's been a real treat putting this show together for our airwaves. You can check out this and all past episodes on our CFRC podcast feed. And until next summer, that was The Kingston Curator, and this is Lauren Tucker, signing off on 101.9 FM CFRC. Have a fantastic weekend, autumn, and beyond.
Citizens to join in on this global Black philanthropy initiative. This special fundraising effort assists the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals for Black serving nonprofit organizations. Tackle issues close to home, from poverty to quality education, gender equality to economic growth. Individuals and businesses can participate in this fundraiser, internationally administered by Support Black Charities. Visit global-bpi.org to learn more and spread the message. Donate today at global-bpi.org.
For 142 years, the Queen's Gaels have called Kingston home. The tricolor has become as synonymous with the city as the limestone upon which it was built. But that love, admiration, and respect comes with a powerful commitment. A pledge to protect this house. On Saturday, August 31st, the Queen's Gaels will host the McMaster Marauders for their home opener at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Kickoff is scheduled for 6 p.m. and CFRC's coverage will begin at 5:45.
The AMS Food Bank provides confidential and non-judgmental food options to members of the Queens community in the most comfortable environment possible. The Food Bank helps to ensure that Queens students can be healthy and productive as they pursue academic achievement and alleviates poverty amongst Queens community members. We are open Monday to Friday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in room 105 of the Rideau Building. For entry into the Food Bank, we ask to see the sticker on the back of your student card to ensure you are a valid student. We have an amazing team of volunteers to welcome you and answer any questions you may have. To donate, you can e-transfer controller at ams.queensu.ca with the subject line AMS Food Bank Donation, or bring non-perishables to our location during the service hours. Also check out the Pay What You Can Peach Market, providing equal access changing hunger, in the new medical building for fresh soup and entrees on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. For any questions, please reach out to foodbank@ams.queensu.ca.